You're listening to That Life Then. Let me out here. Written and read by Jack Merrill. I was on stage at 19, performing the Monday Night Improv show at Second City in Chicago. My fellow improvisers and I were pulling together a scene through audience suggestion, and somebody said we should do it as a restoration comedy. I'd never heard of a restoration comedy. Sounded like something old. Everyone else, on stage and off, seemed to have some understanding of what this meant, but I didn't. The thing I left with that night was that I'd remain a fucking idiot the rest of my life if I didn't figure out some way to continue my education. See, I hadn't paid much attention during high school, as there were some external issues fighting for my time, like my fucking insane family. And now, here I was finally free of them all, flying along, flying, in fact, with some really talented people, yet without basic educational underpinnings. Now, I'm not saying everybody has to know what a restoration comedy is. I'm just saying it was a flare, and I took note. Just because my parents didn't give a shit if I had a decent education wasn't a reason to stop me from figuring out how to get one. Thanks to some directional repositioning, I got myself over and into the University of Illinois at Chicago Circle campus, where I spent an uneventful year filled with uninspiring classes while continuing to work in restaurants and late-night clubs. It felt like I was headed in the right direction, but something was missing. Even while hungover and half asleep, I still had a couple teachers tell me if I focused myself more and upped my game, I could get into a top school. But where? And how? And there were so many things I wanted to do with my life, it was confusing. And then I saw the movie Fame. That was it. Now I knew that no matter what, I had to move to New York City to pursue the life of an actor. And once I got there, I'd sort it all out one way or another. After my move to New York, and a year or so spent at some total nonsense, I once again trained my sights on getting that education I knew I needed. Somehow, somewhere, I heard that New York University had just built a beautiful new gym complex below Washington Square Park, and they had a renowned acting program, in that order. So I called up NYU, and I asked them how one would go about getting into their great new gym. I called them up, and I asked how one would go about getting into their renowned acting program. The person on the other end of the line said I needed to make an appointment for an audition and bring a monologue. And I asked, what's a monologue? Seriously, that's what I asked. What's a monologue? Ugh, God. Anyway, whoever was on the phone was very nice and told me to go over to the drama bookstore and they'd hook me up. And I did. I went over to the drama bookstore, which was on the second or third floor of a building overlooking Times Square. This outing made me feel like I was finally on the road to becoming an actor, as the drama bookstore was right near where the redheaded kid's loft was supposed to have been in the movie Fame. Although I'd already figured out that nobody actually lived up there, in those windows, between the signage above the Palace Theater. It was just a location, but a really cool one at that. And I searched out and found the exact window they'd used overlooking the Panasonic sign, which was the coolest sign in Times Square by far, wrapping itself around the entire corner of a building that was like 10 stories high, blinking away, saying, slightly ahead of our time, in bright sweeping colors. Oh, I loved that sign. So, I'm in the drama bookstore, and I asked where I could find the monologues, and this goth-looking girl dressed in all black pulled a thin little paperback off a shelf, which I bought from her, and then I went back to my one-room apartment that didn't overlook the Panasonic sign, but was still cinematic in its own right, as it had a bathtub shower stuck up on a platform right next to the front window. I don't know why anyone would put a bathtub on a platform blocking the front window of an apartment, but they did. When you walked into my little studio along the right wall, it went window, bathtub shower, stove, sink, refrigerator, closet, half wall, bed slot. Not bedroom, bed slot. That just fit a queen-size bed from the half wall to the back wall. There wasn't even room for a bedside table. The bathroom was barely big enough for the toilet and had one of those old-fashioned wall-mounted wooden water tanks with a hanging pull cord thing overhead. Yeah, you had to shave back in the kitchen. The tub shower on the platform gave me the opportunity to look out over the flower district below on 28th Street in the middle of a shower, and anyone walking by could easily look up and catch me soaping it up behind the shower curtain in the third floor window. Sitting on my 1930s Art Deco tubular love seat I dragged with me from Chicago, I read through my little paperback monologue book, and I chose to memorize a monologue from a play called Indian Wants the Bronx by Israel Horwitz. I didn't understand what it was about, But the little monologue book said that Al Pacino had been in the original production of the play, and I knew who Al Pacino was, and I figured if it was good enough for him, it was good enough for me, whether I understood it or not. The appointed day arrived, and I got myself down to Washington Square, found the undergraduate drama department, and got up in front of the assembled decision makers like something out of that scene in Flashdance, a movie I'd be loving in a couple years. Except instead of auditioning by dancing in a black leotard with leg warmers to What a Feeling, I'd be reciting, and I do mean reciting, the speech I'd memorized from Indian Wants the Bronx by Israel Horwitz. God knows what I did with that monologue, I'm sure it was a mess. But the guy who was running the auditions was really nice and pulled me aside afterwards and said that although I hadn't a clue what I was doing, I had talent, and he wanted me to be part of the undergraduate drama department at New York University. He even said I could begin mid-year in January, which was just a few weeks away. There were only 10 slots available, and I could have one if I wanted it. Well, of course I wanted a mid-year slot. What else was I doing? A bunch of nothing. And I had to get a move on and start studying so I could finally get on with my new life as an actor, with or without a view of the Panasonic sign. NYU was incredibly generous, offering me all kinds of financial aid, as I'd been independent for years already, and my grades at the U of I were decent. You know, I'd like to take a second here to note that if it wasn't for the Pell Grant program, I never would have been able to attend New York University. NYU may sound like a state school, but it's not. It's a very expensive private school that I never would have been able to afford were it not for programs like Pell Grants, which themselves were cut way back not long after I got mine. So you can tell your crazy uncle at Thanksgiving when he starts going off about taxes and the government wasting his money and blah, blah, blah. You tell him that education programs should not be cut. You know someone who owes his life to one of those programs he thinks are so careless and wasteful. You tell him he should focus his anger on wealthy people and corporations who don't pay their fair share, and not on needy students. Anyway, I filled out all the NYU paperwork, financial and otherwise, but the deadline for enrollment mid-year was getting close, and NYU needed a hard copy of my transcripts from the University of Illinois, which the U of I had put in the mail. The U of I didn't use FedEx back then. I'm thinking hardly anybody did. Take a moment and imagine that. So my transcripts were sent to New York by snail mail, which they didn't call it yet, and they didn't make the deadline. And now I'd have to wait till September to be able to go to NYU's new gym. I'd have to wait till September to be able to go to NYU's renowned acting program. When I called the day after the deadline to check and see if my transcripts had arrived, a woman answered the phone and told me that, in fact, they had not. I told her I didn't know what to do, as I was planning to start school next week, not in September, 9 months away. She said perhaps I should consider going to another school for a semester and knock off some of the classes that NYU required. That sounded like a solid plan, and I asked her where I could go that I could get in on such short notice. She told me she wasn't allowed to recommend colleges, but there was a school she knew to be highly considered up on Park Avenue in the 60s. The next day, I enrolled at Hunter College for the semester without the need of my transcripts from the University of Illinois. I had a couple extraordinary professors at Hunter, one who taught economics and another who taught political science. Hunter College was a great experience for me and holds the distinction of being the first school I'd ever attended where I was both engaged and intellectually challenged. The semester flew by, and now I had the summer free before I was to start NYU. The last thing I wanted to do was go work in another restaurant. And one day I had the good luck to be walking up 6th Avenue where I spied a gym I'd never noticed before. Now, I don't know if you remember the original Nautilus fitness machines, but they were very cutting edge in 1982. The company's still around, but not anywhere near the form it was back in the early 80s. This Nautilus company was franchising out gym equipment as well as their name, presenting themselves as a cool new alternative to plain-looking gyms that just had a bunch of free weights laying around. The deal was something along the lines of they provided all the workout equipment and the training brochures and the t-shirts for the trainers, and all the franchisee had to do was find some real estate and some nitwits to work there. Fitness was in an interesting place in 1982. Jane Fonda had just released her first workout video that year, and people were becoming more and more aware of their bodies and their fitness. Back in Chicago, before I'd moved to New York, from the time when I was 16 and had heard Donna Summer sing Love to Love You on the radio, a literal plastic transistor radio, not the big old-fashioned kind she was sitting on the top of on the cover of her album on the radio. Once I heard her singing Love to Love You, I became like one of those sailors in the mist about the sirens. Everything kind of melted away. I dropped what I was doing, armed myself with fake IDs, headed downtown Chicago, and jumped high up on whatever speaker or elevated platform I could find to rip my shirt off and dance till dawn. This abrupt change of scenery had made me acutely aware of my body. Or should I say, aware of my body's effect on others. I was no athlete in high school, and most people who remember me from back then would tell you I was a little guy without much in the way of muscles. But I soon learned that my brand of scrawn was not without its admirers. In fact, it turned out I had a body that got me lots of attention up there on whatever speaker or platform I'd chosen to dance the night away. People thought the clubs where I was doing all this shirtless elevated dancing were paying me to get up there and jump around. I just wanted to get away and be left alone in a crowd. Dancing up high overlooking a club became my perfect escape. I wasn't the only one feeling good about my body. Body awareness had begun pushing front and center. When I was 18, New York Magazine ran a cover story with a big banner headline that read, "The Physical Elite. They run, they work out, they think they're better than you are." There was a photo of some bony, modelly types around my age in workout clothes looking all smug about their fitness. That struck me. I thought, oh yeah? Well, listen up, physical elite. I'm going to get myself in even better shape than all you bony-ass models. I knew who they were talking about. I saw these people all over the near north side of Chicago. There was a new breed coming in, and I was part of it. I used to don this pair of little striped nylon running shorts, and I do mean little, and I do mean short, and I'd go running along the lake or on the gravel horse paths in Lincoln Park. In the summer, I'd treat Lake Michigan as if it were my very own outdoor swimming pool, freestyling along the 5 blocks of uninterrupted concrete wall next to Oak Street Beach. There were new kinds of gyms opening other than the YMCA or the JCC, which was short for the Bernard Horowitz Jewish Community Center in Lincolnwood, just west of Evanston, where I'd grown up. That JCC was the only remotely Jewish thing I can remember my Jewish father ever doing. He said he went there because they gave him a free membership, and he liked the pool. My father was also a member of the stodgy and decidedly not free Illinois Athletic Club down on Michigan Avenue across from the Art Institute. Places like the Illinois Athletic Club were geared more towards massages and handball and 2 martini lunches in formal dining rooms than they were towards actually working out. They were places to take a quick afternoon jog around an indoor track or play squash or take a steam or even a nap. These clubs actually had dark rooms where you could sleep on freshly made-up beds while some random hairy dude snored away right next to you. After your squash or nap or whatever, you could go sit on a big overstuffed leather sofa decades before Restoration Hardware would convince you to put one in your living room, and you could smoke cigars while thumbing through one of the available major newspapers that were conveniently laid out in high-ceilinged, classically appointed lounges that, in the case of the Illinois Athletic Club, afforded sweeping views out over Grant Park and onto Chicago's spectacular lakefront. Or you could stroll on over and check in with the familiar maitre d' at whichever grandly proportioned dining room was currently serving, and grab yourself a martini. Or maybe a scotch on the rocks with a toasted turkey club cut on the bias, all brought to you by a virtual army of friendly, attractive black men, all put together perfectly in starchy white uniforms. Every club of any merit had a square-jawed doorman under the front awning who would silently nod at you, knowing just when to blow his whistle for your cab, or when to pop open an oversized umbrella when rain threatened, or just hold the door. All the while tailored up in thick fabrics of gray or blue, with short shoulder capes and jackets festooned with ropes and tassels that smacked of some kind of military wear, or a high school marching band. Those old-fashioned men's clubs were, well, clubby, and they did have their charms. But if one was looking to lean out while adding just a bit of size, so as to look hot while dancing up on the speakers of some gay discotheque till dawn, well, that wasn't really their priority. I didn't want a martini and a cigar while reading the New York Times in a club chair overlooking Grant Park. And I certainly didn't want a nap next to some random hairy dude. I wanted to buff myself up and stake my claim as part of the new physical elite. So I joined the Chicago Health Clubs, a chain that was working overtime to attract this new breed of worker-outers. Chicago health clubs may have been a step in the right direction and certainly filled a much-needed void, but ultimately, the whole thing was total cheese. The branch I joined was in the lower level of Bertrand Goldberg's world-famous brutalistic expression in reinforced concrete, Marina City. You know Marina City, those twin buildings that look like enormous gray corn cobs on the banks of the Chicago River and always find their way into any photo collage of Chicago. This basement branch was outfitted with wall-to-wall orangey-purple shag carpeting and sported a diagonal, thick, striped paint job in those very same questionable colors. There were racks of shiny chrome free weights and a couple standalone weight machines. The low-ceiling gym was chock full of beefy guys carrying significant layers of Chicago chub, who wore thick leather belts tightly cinched around their midsections, which they supposedly wore to stop their backs from giving out while they loudly grunted and groaned as they picked up way too much weight and then threw it back down on the orangey-purple shag with a reverberating masculine thud. Because masculinity was really what it was all about, right? I mean, that's what we were all doing there, solidifying our masculinity. Now, this was right at a time that the very definition of masculinity was beginning to come into question, and the men of Chicago were not very happy about this development. You see, this whole fitness craze had another side to it. Guys weren't supposed to care about the way they looked. Caring about the way you looked was, well, faggy, as they used to say. Guys weren't even supposed to acknowledge how they looked or whether or not they were fit. If you told those men of Chicago back then that one day guys just like them would be willing to agree to daily skincare regimens, you would have caused a massive angry riot. The way I was raised, men were just strong. That was the way they were supposed to be. Being a man meant being strong. But looks? Men weren't supposed to be concerned about the way they looked. And men certainly weren't allowed to mention anything about the way another man looked. I mean, you could say anything you wanted about the way a woman looked, good or bad, but you weren't supposed to judge or really even notice the men around you. Well, not in that way. Under certain circumstances, you could comment that a guy was in good shape. But guys were reluctant to even say that about another guy. And I was learning that that reluctance may have been well-founded because most of the guys who told me I was in good shape were usually interested in playing around with a few of those shapes. A man didn't take care of himself. A man ate and drank and smoked and battled Chicago's brutal winters and woke up and did it all again. A man's body stayed in shape because it did, until it didn't. And that was okay too. Bodybuilders were considered an oddity and kind of got a free pass, but also kind of didn't. There was a sort of wink-wink attitude about bodybuilders, like it was a given that they and the guys who followed them were kind of fringy weirdos. Arnold Schwarzenegger was beginning to change all that, but it was still early. If a guy was absolutely inescapably good-looking, another guy could say he was a ladies' man. That was an easy way to say a guy was hot. Ladies' man was safe because there were girls involved. But that was it. That was all you could say. Guys never said another guy was handsome or good-looking. Girls were hot and sexy and beautiful. Men were not. The first time I heard a guy say that another guy was beautiful, I was like, what? Really? Oh. Yeah. Maybe. A man didn't compliment another man physically because then you were feminizing him. And no guy, not in the Chicago of my youth anyway, wanted to be feminized in any way. Now, however, there was this new group on the move, coming into their own, who were beginning to change some perceptions and were also vying for some physical elitism. The gays. The gays were migrating to big cities seeking freedom from the bigotry they faced in smaller towns. It's important to note that while there were plenty of lesbians moving in and doing their part, from where I stood and from what I saw, the majority of the visible gays in the Chicago of my youth were guys. I was very cognizant of this at the time. I found it fascinating that if you went to a gay bar in a smaller city, the percentage of lesbians went up. The larger the city, the less lesbians. Like some sort of inverse scale. The way I saw it was that if you were a gay woman, society was able to look the other way pretending not to see you, so you could pretty much stay put. You know those terms that were tossed around, Boston marriage or some other nice euphemism. I'm not saying gay women had it easy. I have no doubt it was hell. But I am saying that from what I was seeing, their gayness was being ignored in a way that for us guys was not. I always chalked it up to my male domination theory of homophobia. Think about it. If you look at any straight male porn, there's always a couple girls going at it. However, those girls aren't lesbians. They're just there to provide more fun for the guys. Because everything's for the guys, right? Now, if you happen to be a guy, and you happen to play around with another guy, even once, you're gay. Period. I know things are loosening up in this area, and it's about time. But still, how can women fool around with other women and still be straight, yet a dude plays around a couple times and he's hooked on cock for life? What is that? My theory is in a male-dominated society, everyone wants the male. Or so that's the pitch. Once you've had it, it's so powerfully good, you'll never go back to anything else. So therefore, if you're a lesbian, you're really not gay, because deep down you want a dude. And if you're a guy and you play around with another guy, you're forever gay. Which means you're a fag and not masculine and not to be taken seriously and blah, blah, blah. And then there's this whole thing with religion. They always used to talk a lot about the evil draw of the homosexual lifestyle. Remember Anita Bryant? She was that smiling, good Christian woman who went from doing orange juice commercials to being one of the biggest gay haters of all time. An odd transformation, that's for sure. I remember a guy at a bar yelling up at one of her commercials, "Good luck getting your hair done, honey." Anyway, old Anita's big phrase was, "They can't reproduce, so they recruit." That was her big line. Like the gays were an army on the march to swell their numbers, and if you didn't watch out, you'd turn gay. Which at the time struck me as odd, because let's say you did try something with someone. What, is that it? There's no going back? Ever? Sounds more that everyone really wants the cock thing to me. And then there's all the things the Bible says you can't do that people do all the time. Like eat shellfish and bacon. And how come these religious people aren't going after this whole ripped jean thing? I mean, believe me, I think it's the most ridiculous thing ever. I mean, how absurd is it to see someone who looks like they've spent a week putting themselves together, tooling around in jeans with the little cuts all over them? I mean, come on. What is that? But the Bible actually says, "Neither rend your clothes lest ye die, unless wrath come upon all the people." How come they're not going after the Kardashians? Huh? And then there's divorce and jewelry and on and on and on. But what do they focus on? "You shall not lie with a male as a woman." Okay, and that's another thing. I'd like to note that having been both places, they're very different experiences. So I'd like to tell whoever wrote that, that perhaps they should stick with that for which they know. Anyway, what, they overlook everything else but sleeping with another dude? Why? And I can't get a decent answer from anyone on this. The thing that really got me going was when those religious charmers said I was a degenerate. That really pissed me off. Look, clearly I'm self-obsessed, and I have a raft of other issues. But a degenerate? I don't think so. Degenerate sounds corrupt and criminal, like someone who's out to harm people and should be locked away. I didn't like anyone characterizing me that way. I was just living my life. I wasn't in anyone's way. I wasn't calling them names. Why were they so motivated to try to make me feel bad about myself? Now, I have a pretty fucking hard shell. It wasn't going to be so easy for them to get me to self-hate. But I could see the damage they were doing all around me. Most gay guys in my generation felt like shit about themselves because that's all they ever heard. That they were the dregs of humanity, abomination, a bunch of, well, degenerates. I'd been lucky. I didn't come from a religious family. I never went to church or temple. I didn't grow up and then suddenly have to throw away a belief system that had been pounded in my head since I was a little kid just so I could learn to try to accept myself and possibly have some sort of positive mental outlook. I'd had the great fortune of falling in love with a beautiful boy in high school, and although my friends didn't like it, they dealt with it. My coming out story, although containing heartache like any teenage love, was anything but tragic. Plus, I didn't trust my family anyway, and had bolted from them at 16. And my bolting was not because of my sexuality. It was because they were fucking nuts. But most all the gay guys I was meeting had gotten kicked out by their families and their churches and their friends, if they'd actually been able to make real friendships while being pushed around and called a fag. Almost every gay guy I met had been bullied in one form or another, and I was told endless stories about them getting beaten up. Horrible shit was the norm. I mean, back then, if you wanted to beat somebody up and not get in trouble, you beat up the fag. There's a war out there, and it's still being fought all over the globe. But in the Chicago of my youth, this bigotry was finally being called out, And that was causing a migration from the small towns all over America as these guys started to realize that they too had the right to the pursuit of happiness. And they headed for the cover the big cities offered. A new life was dawning, a newfound freedom. These gays were streaming into Chicago from all over and fixing up ignored shitty neighborhoods that possessed great physical proximity, yet lacked the amenities that straight people looked for. The gays didn't have kids back then. They didn't care about local schools or supermarkets or even what most people would call safety. They were considered fringe themselves, so street people didn't scare them. They themselves were people of the streets. Empty loft buildings overlooking deserted parts of town were nothing new. In fact, that was where you could usually find the gay bars. Before cell phones or Grindr or rainbow flags or any of that shit, I was proud of my ability to find where the gays were hiding out in any decent-sized American city. My formula was simple. When driving in on a freeway or a highway or whatever, depending on the city, I'd look for a sign that said downtown exits or something along those lines. Then I'd get off at the first exit once I could see some decent-sized downtown buildings, but just before they were parallel to the highway. I hope that makes sense. Then I'd drive up to whatever light or stop sign there was to drive up to and turn towards the downtown buildings. Then, at the first or second light or stop sign, I'd take a right and start looking around. 9 times out of 10, I'd find myself in an old factory or warehouse district at the edge of downtown that was deserted at night except for the gays. You could spot the bars. They never had an obvious name out front, just a low-key neon beer sign in a nondescript window with a plain front door. My point being, the gays inhabited the edges back then, literally and figuratively. Most gay guys had given up on the idea that society at large was going to be accepting them anytime soon, so they set about busily building an alternative universe. They took over neighborhoods and beaches, certain areas of parks, and for the most part, they stayed there. They even talked about keeping to these areas where they could feel safe and comfortable, which was another thing I didn't like. I didn't see why I shouldn't be comfortable going wherever I wanted. You know, something interesting happened just the other day concerning this. I was watching RuPaul's Drag Race. Don't start with me. And there's this famous drag queen named Trixie Mattel. And she was teaching a straight guy how to do drag. And on the show, they do the comment interviews when she's dressed as a guy. So this Trixie person was saying how great it was to get to know a straight guy because he had no straight friends. As straight guys had always made him feel like he didn't belong and they made him nervous or something to that effect, so he'd stayed away from them his whole life. To me, the fact that in 2020, a successful entertainer, and I don't care if he's a drag queen, he's a very successful man and I'm sure he can make choices in his life. And the fact that he still carries around that belief system, it blows my mind. And I totally see how it's well-founded and I don't blame him. It just makes me sad. And I think RuPaul's brilliant on a lot of levels. Anyway, back in Chicago, the gay guys stuck together and the rest of society went about their business pretending not to see them. It was a strange compromise. They were allowed to be freer and more accepted as long as everybody else didn't have to acknowledge them while they exercised their newfound freedom. The only thing society up to that point had given gay guys credit for was their supposedly innate creativity, which was a nice way of saying they knew how to froof up a room, or cut some hair, or dress up a store window, or some other job that real men weren't supposed to be interested in doing. What I used to think of as the frivolous professions were left to what was thought of as the frivolous homosexuals. This is another thing that really pissed me off. I knew the truth. Gays worked everywhere, in all professions. It's just that back then, most of them had to hide, or at least politely pretend to be straight because Mark and Karen didn't want to think about what could go on between two guys when the lights went off. Or worse, when the two guys left the lights on. But the wheels were in motion, no matter how slowly they were turning, and these gay guys kept populating the big cities, and they were realizing that they had some economic power, as a high percentage of them held well-paying jobs, and they weren't for the most part supporting families, which gave them nice chunks of disposable income that they weren't afraid of spending. One of the areas the gays grabbed for themselves in Chicago is what is now known as River North, but back then, it was just called shitty and deserted. It was a classic gay area, empty blocks of quiet warehouses right off downtown that held a smattering of gay bars on either side of Clark Street, including the legendary Gold Coast, the first leather bar in America. On the corner of Dearborn and Hubbard, there still stands a stone edifice that was once Chicago's main courthouse, where many infamous trials took place, including the sensational 1925 Leopold and Loeb murder trial, which concerned two wealthy University of Chicago students who murdered a 14-year-old boy because, Well, because they thought they could get away with it, as well as other 1930s spectacular headline-grabbing murder trials that inspired entertainment juggernauts like The Front Page and the musical Chicago. What is now known as the Black Sox trial also occurred on site when in 1919, 8 players on the Chicago White Sox were accused of colluding with gamblers to throw the World Series. Incidentally, the Black Sox scandal inspired John Sayles to write and direct 8 Men Out, the first movie ever to hire me as an actor. By the time I came upon this looming stone fortress of a courthouse, it was blackened with soot and stood solemnly casting a nighttime shadow over the surrounding blocks that were thick with gay men as they roamed from one bar to the next. Late one night, some guy told me they used to hang criminals on outdoor gallows set up in the back, which turned out to be true. Directly across Hubbard Street, where there now stands a 27-story Marriott Residence Inn, there used to be a nightclub that gave the gays in Chicago a well-deserved injection of social cachet. It was a big warehouse of a disco called the Bistro. It was Chicago's answer to Studio 54, and after passing through its portals one night when I was a mere 16 years old, I went nearly batshit crazy. For the next 4 years, I could be found many a night dancing my underage ass off till closing time, which was 4 in the morning, except Saturdays, when it was 5. Disco music was filled with positive imagery about acceptance and love, renewal, rebirth, and taking charge of your life. The gays ate it up. For the first time since, like, ancient Greece, the gays were beginning to feel a little bit of self-acceptance. I was certainly feeling good about myself and my sexuality. If the term pansexual had been around back then, I would have had it printed on my forehead. I was sleeping with women and men, and I loved being a sexual person. I liked being desired and being fit, and I wasn't ashamed of it. I'd stopped buying into that bullshit that good health was something that just happened. And I didn't give a shit if people, particularly people in my family, made it very clear to me that they thought it was selfish and superficial to want to take care of yourself. I was now a member of the physical elite, and the physical elite ran and worked out. Being healthy and being sexual meant having control over your life. It meant making your own choices and your own decisions. It was at this moment that the movie Looking for Mr. Goodbar came out. I saw Looking for Mr. Goodbar at the Esquire Theater on Oak Street, right off the corner where Oak intersects with Rush. That corner of Oak and Rush is featured prominently throughout the movie as it's depicted as the neighborhood where Diane Keaton lets herself go wild, cruising the bars for dudes after long days spent teaching deaf kids. A couple of downtown friends and I saw Late Show, and we were a little stunned when we walked out of the Esquire Theater and right into the late night scene that had just been depicted up on the screen. We were what we had just watched. In Goodbar, Diane Keaton is torn between her oversexed druggie sister and her strict old school parents. She wants to become her own person and reinvent herself and love sex and feels fine about treating men like sexual objects. That movie spoke to me and where I saw myself in the world. Somehow I managed to brush off the ending where Tom Berenger starts fooling around with Diane Keaton, but he can't get it up because he's gay and freaks out to the extent that he stabs her multiple times, killing her in the last frame. I didn't see Looking for Mr. Goodbar as a morality tale of a bad girl who gets hers. What I took home was that she embodied new ideas of freedom because she didn't want to get married and she didn't want to have kids and she liked living alone. I didn't want to get married and I didn't want to have kids. And I was living alone, and nobody, and I mean nobody, I knew from Evanston was living alone in downtown Chicago at my age. When Diane Keaton yelled at Richard Gere that she was alone, not lonely, I took it as a mantra. Being an individual and unafraid to live alone and not conforming to some ancient belief system that told people how they were supposed to be and who they were allowed to fall in love with. And if you weren't able to do what they said, you were worthless. A degenerate. Fuck that. I had some idea of who I was, and I wasn't afraid to continue to figure it out, wherever that took me. I was taking command of my body and reveling in being desired and being sexual. It was all tied up to my individuality, my authenticity, and my freedom. And not just me, but with everyone I was meeting, gay and straight. These themes were swirling around and picking up steam, fueling everything from the music to the fashions to the clubs to the language and gestures of expression, changing the way people saw themselves as we were being given some opportunity to be happy and healthy and free to love the people we were attracted to. Because that is truth. And I was going to live it.